Welcome to another Salvation by Grace Sunday morning message from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently engaged in a verse-by-verse exposition of the book of Hebrews. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We're in the book of Hebrews. Turn there. Hebrews 2. Last week, we got almost to the end of the chapter, and I said that I wanted to wait and deal with the last four verses separately because there's just so much going on in those four verses. So I want to take the time to be specific about those four verses. The next couple of ideas that the writer of Hebrews is going to introduce in his letter, and again, he says things quickly, he's writing in shorthand, he assumes that his audience knows a lot of the theological basis behind these things, and he only starts to extrapolate when he feels like he's approaching a topic that hasn't really been addressed in the other church epistles or theological epistles. For instance, he's going to introduce the concept of Jesus as high priest here at the end of chapter 2. And he's just going to kind of say it and move on, because in a couple of chapters he's going to return to that idea and he's going to develop it more fully. And he's going to confront the historic reality that no high priest, nobody working in the temple, ever came from the tribe of Judah, and that it's clear that Jesus came from the tribe of Judah. Only the Levites could ever serve in the temple or serve as high priests. So he's going to have to talk about that. He's going to have to extrapolate on that because no other writer of any other New Testament epistle does that. So he's going to develop that theology and reach back to Melchizedek, and we'll get to all that. So he's going to talk about high priest, but in the course of talking about Jesus as high priest, he's also going to use the word propitiation. It's a very interesting Greek word that has a lot of connections to the Old Testament and to the Ark of the Covenant and to the Day of Atonement. And again, to his first century Hebrew audience, they would have grabbed all those connections. They would have understood those connections. We don't understand them as readily as 21st century Gentile Christians, so we're going to dig into that this morning. From there, he moves into the contrast between Jesus and Moses, and he does a little bit of clever wordplay with the word house and talks about the house of Israel, over which Moses was a faithful leader. But then he talks about Jesus as the builder of the house, and he's going to say that the one who builds the house is superior to the servant who serves in the house. And so that's going to demonstrate Christ's superiority over Moses. And from there, he's going to introduce one of the biggest concepts to the Hebrew mindset, which is the concept of rest. And in chapter 3 and into early chapter 4, he's going to talk about the promise of rest. Because one thing that the Israelites were promised all the way through the Old Testament was that eventually they were going to be in their own land and they were going to rest in their land. They were no longer going to be in fear of being inhabited or being thrown out or being scattered, and that they were going to have rest from their enemies, and there was going to be plenty of food, so they would have rest from the labor of making and getting food, and that they were one day going to finally be able to sort of collectively exhale and know that their relationship with God was finally and eternally secure. And they simply have not ever had that, and still don't to this very day. And so the writer of Hebrews is going to talk about that and then get into Sabbath rest in early chapter 4. So the next couple of weeks, we're going to be grabbing these really big, very important concepts that to us now as Gentile folks, it doesn't resonate with us quite the same way that it would resonate to a first century Hebrew. So I'm going to try very hard to help us understand that first century Hebrew mindset so that we can see the importance of this language. For instance, they all know, as I just said, that the high priesthood is descendants of Aaron, Moses' brother, and it has to be the tribe of Levi. And so when he jumps in verse 17, and makes mention of a merciful and faithful high priest and says that it's Jesus, this was earth-shaking to them. This was a radical concept. because he doesn't qualify to be high priest. And so he's going to have to explain in what way he is a high priest, and the way he's going to start explaining it is by explaining what Jesus did as high priest. So let's start reading in verse 14. Since then the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise also partook of the same, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is the devil, and might deliver those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. That's how far we got last week. Verse 16, for assuredly he does not give help to angels, but he gives help to the descendants of Abraham. Notice the particular nomenclature there. He gives help to descendants of Abraham. He's not talking about universal help. He's talking about particular help. You have to keep that in mind because to the Hebrew mindset, they understand that the high priesthood and the Levitical priesthood was itself exclusive. In other words, the high priest, when he went and stood in the tabernacle, in the holiest place, when he stood there on the Day of Atonement, he was atoning for particular people. Let's take a look at it. Turn back to the book of Exodus for a moment. Keep your finger there in Hebrews because we're coming back. Turn to Exodus 28. Exodus 28. This is the description of the garments that the high priest had to wear when he went before God. And the garments themselves just cry of exclusivity, of particularity. When the high priest went in and made atonement, he was not atoning for Eskimos or Australians or Incas or Red American Indians. He was atoning for a particular group of people, and the clothing he wore designated the people that he was in there acting on behalf, if that was indeed a sentence. Start in verse 4. These are the garments that they shall make, a breastpiece and an ephod and a robe and a tunic of checkered work, a turban and a sash, and they shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his sons, that they may minister as priest before me. And they shall take the gold and the blue and the purple and the scarlet material and the fine linen, and they shall also make an ephod of gold and of blue and of purple and of scarlet material and fine twisted linen, and it shall be the work of a skillful workman. It shall have two shoulder pieces joined at its two ends, that it may be joined, and the skillfully woven band which is on it shall be like its workmanship, of the same material, of gold, of blue, of purple, and of scarlet material, and fine twisted linen. And there shall be two onyx stones, one for each shoulder, and you will engrave on them the names of the sons of Israel, six of their names on the one stone, and the names of the remaining six on the other stone, according to their birth. So the weight that is on the shoulders, the onyx stones that are carried on the shoulders of the high priest, designate who it is he's in there atoning for, the people of Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel, as a weight on his shoulders. But then, verse 12 says, you shall put the two stones on the shoulder pieces of the ephod as stones of memorial for the sons of Israel. And Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord on his two shoulders for a memorial. So who's he in there for?
Israel.
It's just as plain and as clear and precise as it can possibly be. Then he goes on and says, verse 15, you will make a breastplate of judgment, the work of a skillful workman, like the work of the ephod you shall make it, of gold and blue and purple and scarlet material, and fine twisted linen you shall make it, and it shall be square and folded double, a span in length and a span in width, and you shall mount on it four rows of stones. The first row shall be a row of a ruby and a topaz and an emerald. The second row, a turquoise, a sapphire, and a diamond. The third row, a jacinth and an agate and an amethyst. The fourth row, a beryl and an onyx and a jasper. And they shall be set in gold filigree. And the stones shall be according to the names of the sons of Israel, 12 according to their names. They shall be like the engravings of the seal, each according to his name for the 12 tribes. In other words, the 12 tribes of Israel are a burden on his shoulders and in gold as precious stones over his heart. And then he goes in to make intercession for those people. Now, the first century Hebrew knows this. Go back to the book of Hebrews now. They know that history, and they know that a high priest intercedes for particular people. Nowhere in the Bible do you even find the concept of a universal high priest who universally intercedes for all mankind before God. That doesn't exist. And so when the writer of Hebrews makes reference to Jesus as high priest, they immediately understand that this is an exclusive office and that he's atoning for particular people. Now, one of the things that the high priest did that was so very, very important is that he would get between the people and God. And as a representative of the people and as an emissary of God, he would make reconciliation between the two sides. And the way that he would make that reconciliation was with blood sacrifice, which had to be done on the kapporeth, on the covering on top of the Ark of the Covenant, the gold box that had the Ten Commandments inside it. He had to go in and do the atoning work in order for God to suspend judgment from those people for another year until the next Day of Atonement, next Day of Atonement, next Day of Atonement. Now, the writer of Hebrews is later going to tell us that the blood of goats and bulls could never finally do away with sin. All it was doing was sort of temporarily expiating sin in order for God to withhold judgment until the final sacrifice got here. So all of those sacrifices pointed forward to the final sacrifice to come. But the high priest had to do it every year. He had to go in on the Day of Atonement. He had to stand in front of the Ark of the Covenant. He had to sprinkle blood on the kapporeth, the covering, which would have been, under any normal circumstances, a judgment seat, because inside was the unbroken law. But once the blood was poured on it, it became known as the mercy seat. And that's the best translation of the Greek word that the writer of Hebrews is about to use. I almost said that Paul is going to use, because I'm so convinced of the Pauline theology in the book of Hebrews, and I may make that mistake yet again and say that these are Paul's words, but I'll keep trying to say the author of the book of Hebrews for accuracy's sake. For accuracy's sake. See, if there's any word you ought to pronounce accurately, it's accuracy. Never mind, I'm alone here again. For assuredly, he does not give help. He does not intercede. He does not do anything about the fallen angels, but he does give help to the descendants of Abraham. The descendants of Abraham had always had a high priest who could go in and make atonement for them. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in all things so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the peoples. Now, this is where it really gets interesting. Halaskamai. Now, this word halaskamai is the word that is translated make propitiation for. The concept of propitiation is actually a heathen concept that Paul also uses in the book of Romans in order to explain what Christ was doing on the cross. And it's a really important concept because what it means is to offer up a sacrifice in order to appease the offended party in order to avoid the wrath or the punishment that the offended party could justly dole out. Now, among the heathens, they believed in things like human sacrifice. in order to appease the wrath of their gods. Very common concept among the heathen that their gods were angry, and that when their gods would get angry, you could appease those gods by giving them a human sacrifice. The most common of them was one that the Israelites were specifically told to avoid, which was giving their babies over into the burning hands of Molech, a cast metal god, and they would stoke his belly like a furnace, and when the metal was red hot, they would place their babies in the hands of the red hot god, and the screams and cries of the baby were supposed to propitiate the wrath of Molech as a god. And so the New Testament writers pick up that concept and say one of the things that Jesus did on the cross is that he became the propitiation. He made himself the propitiatory sacrifice. He gave himself up in order to satisfy the wrath of God and the judgment of God. Unfortunately, that idea of propitiation has so much baggage with it that some of your newer translations avoid the word propitiation. And the reason for that is that some translators felt that it created a sort of conflict between the God of the Old Testament, who then becomes the angry God, the angry, vengeful God, and it makes Jesus sort of the good God of the New Testament, who has to appease the anger of the bad Old Testament God. But biblically speaking, it is the Old Testament God who came up with the plan of his son giving up his life in order to appease himself. So the truth of the matter is there is no conflict between Old or New Testament, between God or Christ. And so I don't have a problem with the word propitiation, but some translators avoid the word and go with expiation or go with make reconciliation in order to avoid the more heathen concept of propitiation. Now, this word, halaskomai, there is another version of this word. Hilasterion, one of those two. The writer of Hebrews is also going to use that word later in the book. You see the similarity between this? The root word has to do with gracious blessing that produces a kind of peace and happiness. And it's always the result of the greater doing for the lesser what the lesser can't do. It's the greater pulling the lesser up to himself is the concept. This word, hilasterion, is later translated mercy seat. In the Septuagint, which is the Greek New Testament that was translated by 70 Greek scholars, which was extant during the time that Jesus was walking and talking, and I've told you in the introduction to the book of Hebrews that many of the Old Testament quotes in the book of Hebrews are actually taken from the Septuagint, from the Greek Old Testament, which is why sometimes you'll see slight variances as it moved from Hebrew to Greek to English versus just Hebrew to English. And those minor variations are a result of quoting from the original Hebrew or quoting from the Greek Old Testament. When they came across the word kapareth, kapareth is the word that is the covering on top of the Ark of the Covenant. This is the place where that work is done of covering sin. And the word does mean to cover the sin. You've probably heard of Yom Kippur. That's Day of the Covering. And so in order to move that concept of covering and what really happened at the mercy seat place in order to explain what was going on there, the Greek translators used this word, hilasterion, to translate the covering, the mercy seat, in order to explain that what was happening there was propitiatory, that what was happening there was accomplishing peace between man and God by making reconciliation in blood. To the Greek Old Testament translators, they took that very Greek New Testament concept of propitiation and moved it back into what was happening when the high priest went in front of the mercy seat. But then there was also this English concept, an English phrase, an English common phrase, where two people who had been at odds, who were then unified, were at one with each other. And so in order to help make peace between two people, you would bring them at one. As a consequence, Wycliffe combined at one and came up with the word at-one-ment. We mispronounce it now and call it atonement. And then we say that what Jesus did is he atoned. And we've lost the sense of what that means to say atone, because the word atone doesn't exist. We just say it, and it's become part of our popular vernacular. But whenever you say atonement or atone, you are in fact using two English words that have been stuck together that John Wycliffe did at one. He just took a very common English phrase and said that's what's happening when the high priest goes to the mercy seat and he goes on Yom Kippur to the kapar. I've heard it pronounced kafar because PH in English is an F sound, but he goes to the kapar, which is the covering, on the day of the covering, the Yom Kippur, and he goes to the Kapareth, and you can see why all of those words would need not so much an English translation, but a sort of an English concept attached to them. So Wycliffe went with, well, what's happening there at the mercy seat is God and man are made at one, hence at-one-ment, hence atonement. So I said all that to say, the writer of Hebrews said, assuredly he did not help angels. He gave help to the descendants of Abraham, the very ones who were being atoned for on the Day of Atonement by the high priest. Therefore, he had to be made like his brethren in all things. Brethren in that instance, in context, would be Israelites, descendants of Abraham, that he might become a merciful and a faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, standing between God and man, reconciling the two warring sides. And he did it by making propitiation for the sins of the people. In other words, he perfectly fulfilled what 1,400 years of high priests walking in front of the Kapareth could never actually do. It didn't matter how much blood was poured on the Kapareth, on the covering, on the mercy seat. It didn't matter how many times they did it for 1,400 years, how many goats, how many bulls, how much blood. Didn't matter. It took Jesus as the faithful high priest, as the final high priest, making himself the propitiatory sacrifice, making his blood the blood of the new covenant, finally doing what all of the high priests were all pointing to, which was making final reconciliation between man and God by using himself as the propitiation, and therefore accomplishing the covering that had been predicted through 1,400 years of days of Kapar, of the Yom Kippur, of the day of covering. He finally covered sins for his people. And in so doing, he satisfied all the requirements of the high priesthood. Now, all of that was in that little sentence, in that little phrase, but to the first century Hebrew mind, they knew all that. You say high priest and propitiation, they've got it. They're going right back to mercy seat. They're going right back to Yom Kippur. They're going to high priesthood, Day of Atonement. And the writer of Hebrews says that's what Christ was doing. He is the fulfillment. He is the satisfaction of all of that. For since he himself was tempted in that which he suffered, he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. Now, last week, as we were finishing up, we touched on that phrase, and Dawn said, well, what does that mean, that he was tempted? And I said last week, there are two different Greek words and two different concepts for temptation in the Bible. The first one is, you got all this? Did you get all that? It's gone now, too late. Okay. The first word that's translated tempted in the Bible is this Greek word parazo. And the connotation of it, or the purpose of that kind of temptation, is in order to find fault. It's putting somebody through a trial or a temptation for the purpose of finding fault or making them fall. That's the word that's used when you talk about Jesus being tempted in the wilderness. He was tempted of Satan. And Satan's purpose in tempting him was to find something wrong with him, was to find some fault in him. And of course, Jesus stood up to that temptation, and importantly, stood up to that temptation as our substitute. In our place, confronted Satan's temptation and won over it as a perfect example for us. But then the second word is dokimazo. Dokimazo is a word that was used in metallurgy in order to separate, like, dross from silver. You still hear it today where we use the common phrase, they were testing his metal. You know, you put you through some kind of a difficult time, and they say, oh, that'll test your metal. Well, that's reaching back to this concept, to this word. And what it means is to put silver in a fire, and as the fire burns the silver, the dross burns off, and you end up with the pure silver afterwards. And I've heard many a good sermon that expands on this idea and says that the refiner finally knows when he has pure silver and the dross is all burned off, when he can look at the silver and see his own reflection coming back at him. That's when he knows that it's done. Well, Paul picks up this same concept. It's a very common New Testament idea that we are tried in the fire. You've heard that phrase enough times. So the idea behind tried in the fire is that we are going through trials and temptations in this life, and the purpose of them is not our destruction. The purpose is the burning off of the stuff that God needs to get rid of in order to perfect us, in order to complete us until we are more in His image. And so what we read here is that He Himself was tempted, and in that case, it's tempted, the first one, the tempted in order to find some imperfection in him. And that temptation did not accomplish anything. There was no imperfection in him. But he had to be tempted that way so that he could, I like the King James word, so that he could succor, which just means to comfort those who are also being tempted. So the big concept is, as God, sitting at the right hand of God in eternity, as part of the eternal Trinity, as part of the eternal perfection, he could not empathize with the human condition. There was no way for him to experience what we had experienced without becoming flesh and blood. And so the writer of Hebrews says, in order to be like his brethren, he took on flesh and blood. And then becoming flesh and blood, was tempted in all ways like we are, yet without sin. So he knows what it is to be tempted. He knows what it is to be in the battle. He knows what it is to go through the struggles of human flesh. He was hungry. He got tired. He had to sleep. He knew what it was to endure physical pain. He cried out in agony. He prayed until his sweat was like great drops of blood. He knows what it is to agonize in the human condition. Therefore, because he knows what it's like to live in human flesh and to be tempted and to go through those trials, he's able to empathize. He's able to come to the aid of those who are being tempted. So, this is really good news. What this means is when you're going through your own trial, your own temptation, your own problem, you've heard me very, very frequently quote Paul writing to the Corinthians and saying, there is no temptation taking you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted above that which you are able, but will with the temptation provide a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. That's that same idea that God knows what temptation and trial is. There's no temptation or trial you're going to go through that isn't common to human beings. And God knows what the trial is. He's placed it there on purpose for your growth, for your perfection, to burn away the dross, to prove more faith in you, to draw you closer to himself. And he's taking you through that trial on purpose, and we can look to Christ, the author and finisher of our faith. We can look to Christ for our strength in going through these trials, knowing full well that he knows what it's like to be tempted. He knows what it's like to go through it. He's been through it, and therefore he's there to help and to strengthen and to carry us through our trials and our temptations. Let's see if I can bring this down to brass tacks. I made that all very theological, and for the last half hour I've been talking theology, theology, theology. Let's see if I can bring it down to where the rubber meets the proverbial road. Have you ever heard anybody say, "You don't know what it's like"? Have you ever heard that?
Often.
Kids are very big on that one. You don't know what it's like. Every kid, every young man who goes through the first burst of testosterone thinks he's the first one who ever did that. Every young girl who suddenly that switch goes on where the hormones start raging in her, and suddenly she goes through these mood swings. I'm being very careful with my wording right now, I know. Suddenly she goes through these mood swings, and she thinks she's the first one who ever did this. And she'll say to her parent, "You don't know what it's like." Well, of course, when the daughter says that, the mother's going to say, "Yes, I do. I've been there. I've done that. I know exactly what you're going through." Every male can say to any young man, "Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. I've been there. I've done that. How do you think I got to this age? I got to this age by enduring the age you're in right now. Yes, I know it's tough. I know it's difficult." Well, that's actually a great comfort. If you walk around thinking you're the only one, you're the only one, oh, nobody understands, nobody gets me, I'm so deep. If you walk around thinking that nobody comprehends what you're going through, that's a very lonely place to be. But when you finally get brave enough to talk to somebody and you find out that everybody goes through it, well, that's a comfort. It's great when you find out that your parents actually understand. I remember the first time that I had to confess a few things to my dad that I thought, "Oh, he's gonna kill me." I'm debating whether to tell you this story or not. A little story about my wild youth. It was a speeding in my dad's car story. I waited a long time before I told him because, you know, it was his Jaguar. Yeah, I know. E-type Jag, 8-cylinder. He saved up, loved that car, which only ran, you know, like a couple weeks out of the year, and the rest of the time was in the shop anyway. I was 16, and he let me drive it because I was in the Michigan Youth Symphony, so he let me drive it from Livonia to Ann Arbor for rehearsal because the station wagon was with my mom somewhere else. And wouldn't you know, there'd be a girl involved. A girl asked for a ride home, so I was very happy to give her a ride home in my dad's Jaguar. And, you know, chest out, you go, "Oh, yeah, hey, yeah, my car, yes." And so we're driving down the brand new Plymouth Freeway, and there's nobody on it except me doing 70, which was the speed limit there, doing 70, minding my own business, doing fine. And that's when the blue metal flake Corvette came up next to us. And that was not good. Yeah, I know. Oh, I know. And as he came up next to us, you know, he rocked back and forth, rocked back and forth, and then took off. And I let him take off. I was okay with that. Until the girl said, and I quote, "You gonna let him get away with that?" This is not good, because now my manhood's on the line. So in a burst of testosterone, I stepped down on the pedal, and that car took off like a rocket. I was no longer driving, I was just pointing it. And whoom, we raced by the guy in the Corvette. And then I looked down at the speedometer as it was tipping 110. And my first thought was, "Dad will kill me. Dad will kill me. He's going to kill me, and then I'm going to jail." And so I slowed down like mad, you know, got her home. Well, I didn't tell my dad that story for a couple of years because I wanted to let, you know, enough time go by. And one day I told him, and I still feared that he was just going to go crazy on me. And instead, because he's a guy, and because he's the one that bought that car to begin with, said to me, "Really? You got it to 110? I said, "Yeah, Dad." He said, "I only got it to 100 and I got scared." Dad related. That was the point of the story. Dad related. And because he related, I didn't get in trouble. That's what the writer of Hebrews is saying, without talking about Jaguars going 110. He's saying the same thing. He's saying Jesus became flesh and blood, and therefore he can relate. He knows what it is to be human, and he knows what it is to be tempted, and he knows what it is to be hungry and to be tired and to be angry, and he knows what it is to be frightened and to be in pain and to you know, that we read that he cried out in the Garden of Gethsemane and they heard him in that he feared. I mean, he knew what was coming his way. He was very, very human, and we should never forget, as we think about him and we think about his glorified state and we think about him sitting at the right hand of God and we think about him in his majesty and his glory, we should never forget about him sleeping in the bottom of a boat or cooking fish or just being tired, just being weary. He was also very, very human. And because he's human, he understands. Therefore, we can go to him, to the throne of grace, boldly to the throne of grace, knowing that the one who's sitting there has been tempted in all ways like we are, and he knows what it's like. Therefore, he's able to comfort us in our temptations. The good news is, when we fail in our temptations, the very one who is succoring us, the very one who is comforting us in our temptation, also died to propitiate for our sin when we failed. That's how complete our Savior is. When you fail and come up short, he paid for that. So go talk to him about it. When you are in the midst of the temptation and you're afraid you're going to fail, talk to him about it. He knows what the temptation is. He knows what it's like. He relates. He'll help you through it. God has provided a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. If you fail, don't beat yourself up over it. I know people who can't get over failures that they went through 20 years ago. I told Linda this phrase one time, and in her particular line of work, I think she appreciated it. The phrase that I heard was, "Nobody will ever get well until they give up their dream of having a perfect past." At some point, you got to let go of what's happened. Okay, it happened. But as of right now, here today, Christ is still with you. He is still propitiated for what you've done your whole life. He is still taking care of that as high priest, as intercessor, and he is your flesh and blood brother. Therefore, he understands what it was like to be you and what you went through. That's why he paid the price to buy you, to propitiate you, to take care of your sin problem, and to reconcile you to God. So he is a very complete Savior. As a consequence, the writer of Hebrews starts chapter 3 by saying, "Therefore, holy brethren," by the way, holy brethren, that's another one of those phrases that makes it specific. That's another qualifying phrase. He's not talking to everybody universally any more than Christ is high priest of everybody universally. "Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider Jesus the apostle and the high priest of our," some translations will say confession, some will say profession. The word is homologeo. We've talked about it before. It's a combination of the word legeo, words, and homo, which means same. Same words. In other words, when you see in the New Testament the confession that Paul's talking about, our confession, he's actually talking about the same words that all Christians admit to. You keep hearing me say over and over and over again that Christianity is specific. Christianity is definable. Christianity has particular doctrines. Christianity has particular teaching. And we as Christians are to understand all that and then say that as our common confession, the homologeo, the same words. And so we who belong to Christ are to admit that as our confession. He is our faithful apostle and high priest. Now, this is the only place in the New Testament where Jesus is referred to as an apostle. The English word apostle is a transliterated word. It's not even translated. Apostolos is the Greek word, and it just moved into the English as apostle. And what it means is a sent one, an emissary, someone who is sent to do the business of someone else. And so Jesus chose 12 apostolos. He chose 12 apostles. And then he gave them an assignment. He told them who to go to and what to say when they got there. That's definitional to what it is to be an apostle, to be one who is sent, and you're on an assignment, and they are to say particular things, the common confession. They're to preach the gospel. They weren't to go and say anything other than what Jesus told them to say. They're not there to make stuff up. They're not there to tell their own stories or make Jesus more approachable. They're to go say what he said to say. Well, the writer of Hebrews picks up that concept then and says, Jesus himself came to earth and took on flesh because he is a sent one. He is the emissary of God himself sent to the earth to bring the good news to God's people. So our common confession, our homologeo, is that we all admit that Christ is not just high priest, but that he is a faithful high priest to God. He faithfully executed everything that he was supposed to do, and as the emissary, as the apostle of God, he faithfully brought the message that God wanted us to know. The message of Christianity is a message that comes directly from God. We call the Bible the Word of God, and we say that on purpose because the pedigree of the Bible is that it was written by the sent ones, the apostles, that were sent by Christ, and Christ himself taught those apostles the words that the Father gave him to say when he came. So we are reading and understanding and experiencing and living by, ingesting and making part of our thinking, of our consciousness, the very words of God, because God sent his Son to deliver these words that we call the gospel, and then he sent out his emissaries to spread this very gospel. And that's why I keep hammering away on what does the Bible say, as opposed to what is your opinion. You know, the word confession has kind of a checkered past. Those of you who come out of the church at Rome think of confession as going in front of a priest or going into a confessional and trying to list every sin you can think of, everything you've been guilty of for the last week or month or a couple of years or whenever your last confession was. And you go in and say, forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. My last confession was. You tell him when it was. And then you just try to think of everything you can possibly think of so that he can then tell you what you have to do in order to make up for those sins. He gives you some penance to do. And that is a penalty. And so you then say a number of Our Fathers, and you say a number of Hail Marys, you go to a certain number of Masses, and thereby you work off your debt to God. That is not the way the word confession is used in the Bible. Instead, homologeo is used to say, we commonly, as a group of believing Christians, we all say the same words, and the words we say are, our faithful high priest already accomplished the propitiatory work. Therefore, our sin is already paid for. It's paid for completely. We can't do anything more. We can't add anything to it. We don't bring our works or our Hail Marys or our Fathers or our church attendance or going to Mass. We don't bring anything to add to the finished work of what Christ did because he is a faithful high priest and apostle. He brought the words of God. He accomplished everything God sent him to do. He sent his apostles to tell us about what he did, and what he accomplished was what all the high priests had always pointed to, which was final, finished propitiation of the sins of God's people, thereby creating peace and reconciliation between the two sides. And that's a done deal. That's a finished work. There's nothing else for you to add to it, and that's why this news is called really good news. I threw an adjective in there. I threw really in there. It's called good news. I think it's really good news.
Yes.
Because I know me. Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider Jesus the apostle and high priest of our confession. He was faithful to him who appointed him, to the one that sent him. He was faithful to God who sent him, the same way that Moses also was in all his house. Now he's going to begin using this house concept, and he's going to do a little bit of word play here. And it's very, very clever writing. Conceptually, what he's saying is Christ was faithful to God the same way Moses was faithful, but he was faithful in the household in which he served. He was a servant in the house. And of course, this is a reference to the house of Israel. He was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses also was in all his house. For he, Christ, has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses. There's the didactic statement. He has just said Jesus is better than Moses. So he started out by saying Jesus is better than angels. Then he said Jesus is better than all the high priests. And he's going to get back to that. And he's going to argue about Melchizedek. And he's going to show the superiority of it. He's even going to argue that the Levites tithe to Melchizedek, which makes Melchizedek better than the Levites. He's going to make a very convincing argument that Jesus is better than the high priest. Now he just said Jesus is better than Moses. So one by one, systematically, he has been going through every area of worship, every area of interaction and communication that the Israelites had with God in the Old Testament, that the law was administered by angels and it came by Moses, and that it was interceded, they were interceded for through the high priest. He's ticking them down one by one and saying, but Christ is better, but Christ is better, Christ is better. Sure, you had some high priests, Christ is better. Sure, you followed Moses, Christ is better. Sure, the law came by angels, and sometimes angels interceded for you. Christ is better. He is counted worthy of more glory than Moses, by just so much as the builder of the house has more honor than the house. This is a really deep phrase, and I don't want us to just walk by it. Because we all just agreed that the house he is referring to is the house of Israel, that Moses was faithful to his house, all his house, which is only the house of Israel. That's the only group of people who Moses interceded for or brought the law to. Now the writer of Hebrews just said, Christ is the builder of the house. Well, what does that tell you about Israel? It tells you that Christ is the builder and establisher of Israel. I will make the connection again as we go on, but I argue that Melchizedek is a Christophany. And even though Abraham was walking around with the promise that his seed was going to be as numerous as the stars of the heavens or the sands of the sea, and that through his seed all the nations of the earth were going to be blessed, he still didn't have a kid until he met Melchizedek. And once he was blessed by Melchizedek, the promises all started coming. Now the writer of Hebrews, who's got a lot to say about Melchizedek coming up, now says that Jesus himself is the builder of the house. So for the folks who try to make really radical distinctions between Old Testament Israel and then say they've been replaced by the church and Old Testament Israel is now done away with because they were only under the law and they didn't keep that law and therefore they're done, I've written about and talked about God's continuous promises to Israel and the continuity of those promises. I want to add now to our overall theological thinking about Israel that Christ is high priest, faithful high priest to the descendants of Abraham, as it says here, and he is the builder of the house of Israel. I simply cannot conceive of some version of Christ where he establishes a people, builds a house, intercedes for them as high priest, and then disavows them, gets rid of them, and scatters them permanently. I just can't wrap my brain around that kind of thinking. Therefore, I say that this Hebrew, writing to Hebrews, emphasizing the house of Israel and Christ as the builder of the house, is telling them yet again that God is going to be faithful in the promises he has ever made to Hebrews. For he is counted worthy of more glory than Moses, by just so much as the builder of the house has more honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all his house as a servant, for a testimony of those things which would be spoken later. But Christ was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are. Who's we?
Israel.
The believing Hebrews he's writing to? Israelites all. Whose house we are. He just got done saying, Christ is the faithful son over his house, whose house we are. And then he adds the caveat, if we hold fast our confidence and the boast of our hope firm to the end. At this point, he introduces the concept of perseverance. He's going to get back to that idea, and that's where we're going to pick up next week. And we will talk about how the writer continues to construct these warnings that have to do with perseverance, but he's also going to establish where our perseverance comes from and that it is God that causes us to persevere. So don't be afraid of the warning. The warning is real, but with the warning comes the help, as always happens. Are there any questions about that section of the book? I wanted to go slow on purpose because every one of those phrases was just chock full of really important historical information that if you just glance over, you're not going to understand how grand this theology is of the superiority of Christ over every aspect of the Old Covenant. Yes, sir?
Could I apply verse 6 to the church, or should I just keep it in the context of the house of Israel?
I think to be safe, I'll give you two answers. And then you can pick the one you like. First, he says that Christ came for, look at the language back in the end of chapter 2, verse 16, for assuredly he did not give help to angels, but he gave help to the descendants of Abraham. Descendants of Abraham, seed of Abraham is very specific nomenclature, again, that's talking about Israelites, Hebrews, the people he's writing to. So I think that whole context, front to back, is all so Hebraic, so Israelitish, that I don't want to just impose the church onto it, because if we do, then we're really giving way to the replacement theologians who say, well, I know what it says, and I know who it's being directed to, and I know how specific it is, but we're just going to throw church in there. So there's answer number one. Let's leave it specific because it's so specific. Number two, second answer, that's not to say there's nothing here for us to learn. That's not to say just because we don't apply it directly to us as if it's written to us, still it is written for our edification, for our learning, for our growth. And so there's plenty to learn here about the God we're dealing with and about who Christ is and what he has done. But if you want to know who Christ is and what he has done for Gentile believers, us, then spend some time in Galatians and Ephesians and the Corinthian books where Paul is going to say many of the very same things. But the truth of the matter is, if Paul walked into a strictly Gentile audience in the first century and said, let me tell you about the apostle and high priest of our profession, they're going to say, the what? Because they have no background in priesthood or high priesthood. They have no background in Aaron or Moses. All they have are their heathen concepts and heathen background. And so, sure, Paul would go to the Greek philosophers on Mars Hill and he would preach Christ to them. But that was in that Gentile setting, and in that setting, he didn't say anything like this. Instead, he started with, I see you're all too superstitious, and I'll tell you about the unknown God that you don't know. And he started with the God that made heaven and earth. Completely different approach. But when talking to Hebrew believers, the writer of Hebrews uses all this Hebrew language, Hebrew history, Hebrew references, quoting from the Psalms, quoting from Isaiah, because to them, this is all going to resonate. This is their history. when he says descendants of Abraham, and then talks of the house, that's just so specific that I think we do it damage if we stretch it beyond what the original author said. Can we learn from it? Absolutely. Did anybody learn anything this morning? Yeah, we learned a lot. But I won't impose us onto the text if we're not who the writer had in mind. Does that make sense? Okay, was that fair?
Wasn't yes. this the first step of revealing Christ to the world? It was to go to the Jew.
To the Jew first, and also to the Gentile. Yeah.
It was to go there first.
Right, and I have no problem with to the Jew first. I'm just really happy there's an and to the Gentile in there.
Yes.
I mean, remember when Jesus, before his death, burial, and resurrection, when he sent his apostles out, he said, don't go into the way of the Samaritans. Don't go into the way of the Gentiles. Go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And go preach the kingdom. Now, that's always the way it's worked. There's always been that focus on Israel and the Gentiles. And unfortunately, in the last 2,000 years, it's become the focus on the Gentiles, and we're kind of marginal about Israel. I like keeping the focus where the Bible puts the focus, which is to the Jew first, and also to the Gentile.
We thank you for joining us for this Salvation by Grace message. For more information, please visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And join us next time as we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.